From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and today's going to be a great show. I've got my buddy Brett Lawton coming on the show, and just as a reminder, we are always looking to build the Backyard Advantage, which is the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. It's based around this culture of love, and as a member of the Entrepreneurs Organization, I met Brett Lawton, who is a very successful entrepreneur, but when we work together as entrepreneurs, we can go so much farther, and Brett is part of the Growth Factory as well, and so we're all working together to help entrepreneurs in Sacramento, but we also have like our other jobs. So Brett Lawton, he owns Lawton Construction, so we're going to find out his background, and then we're also going to learn about his some of his secrets to success and get to know Brett a little bit. So Brett, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Glad to be here.
We were just talking about your business a little bit. Maybe we can kind of get an overview of what you do and you know, what's different about Lawton Construction.
Sure. We could start at the beginning. So I'm second-generation contractor. My dad started Lawton Construction in the late 70s, obviously way before me. 2006.
Obviously, you don't look that.
I'm 41. So, yeah. 2006, we rebranded to Lawton Construction and Restoration. I took over as CEO. Obviously, we're a full GC contractor, mainly in the restoration space. And then we brought on asbestos abatement, water mitigation, contents, textile restoration. That's also going to be like cleaning of sofas and, you know, furniture, things like that. Mold, hazmat, that kind of stuff.
Interesting. So what led you to the restoration side and then all these different, you know, how'd you make the decision on how to expand?
Great question. So I grew up working with my dad. So obviously I was homeschooled, started working for my dad full time when I was 16, doing mainly, you know, remodel work, drywall work. He was just starting to work with AAA insurance here in Northern California. And I saw all the restoration guys, they'd come in and they'd have a $10,000 scope. They'd be gone in a couple of days and we're there for weeks doing pickouts and all the different things. And I was always attracted to the abatement, demo, mitigation side. It took, you know, some time to get around to it, but I started adding on those additional trades.
Okay.
So we started doing water mitigation first.
So let's walk ourselves through this here. Yeah. So I recently had a flood here at my office and I had to redo everything. And for whatever we called our insurance company and somebody else came out and did the work, we probably should have called you guys.
It's all algorithm, yeah.
Yeah, but we finally, you know, pretty much done with everything. But so there's a flood, there's an issue, fire. Mm-hmm. What are the different issues that happen where you get to call and who calls you?
I mean, right now we're mainly TPA, third-party administrator. So what happens is it's all algorithm-based. And like as of like 2010 moving forward, it went a lot from the relationship-based, you know, your local adjuster, your agent, to you call your insurance company, they go to a TPA program. And it's just a rotation. And it's a rotation door with regards to who you're going to get. You might get us, you might get Serpro, you know, so it's whoever's on the preferred vendor list. And it's all about your score, your cycle time, all these different things that they have that they built that they sell to the insurance company. And that was a big shift for us. So
who do you consider to be your customer? Is it the person that's had the issue with their property or is it the insurance company?
By legality, it's going to be me and the client. So it's going to be B2C. So the client has to sign the contract. The insurance company recommends whoever it's going to be. So just like whoever they recommended to you, you could choose to use them or not, just like when you crash your car.
And then the insurance company reimburses or provides.
Yep,
gotcha. Yep. How many... Percentage-wise, how much is on the insurance side and how much is just somebody called you and they're not running through insurance?
We're like 90% insurance. We're changing our structure now, trying to get a lot more GC work, a lot more property management work, commercial work. We're trying to kind of get all of our eggs out of that one basket, per se. Mm. The market's changed quite a bit in that industry. So when I got into it, it was all relationship-based. I had a group of adjusters I worked with. The margins were really well. They knew me. They respected me. They knew that I would take care of the client. Then you go to scale pretty soon. Now you're just a number.
You're just waiting. It's your turn.
Exactly.
When it's your turn, you get that.
Bingo. Yeah.
But you guys grew pretty big. I mean, you were just talking, you have 30 trucks in your yard and you've got multiple buildings. And so you're not a small entity.
No.
How many employees you guys
have? We did have about 130 employees. We're in three locations. We have a Nevada office, our commercial, our main shop here in Lincoln, and then we have a Benicia satellite office. So we have three locations, two states. And we went from about 130, 150 down to about 70 employees now. same geographic location, but just scaled back the GC side of it and doing more subcontractors.
Interesting. So you made the decision based upon like labor laws in California.
Exactly.
And lawsuits and all the liabilities associated with being a larger employer to be,
yes,
just a little bit smaller employer and start subbing stuff out.
Correct. Yeah. We noticed the margins changed. We went from having great margins. We were a smaller company. We scaled up without processes. We thought we had this, that secret sauce, and we realized we didn't. And labor, like, all we sell is labor. Our product is our crews on site. But when you have that many trucks in the road, it's all about your mid-level managers managing all those crews properly. And it's about your operational capacity and how quick they can get there and how fast they can get it done. And insurance is very regulated. You put a code in, it gives you a price. And that price then goes to the, like, that price could be very lucrative for us, or we could lose our butt.
Well, thinking about that, because on this type of construction project, it's not like you've got this big plan that you put together and, you know, it starts in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
You're out there dealing with, like, our flood. We need to get this thing,
yep,
ASAP.
Day one.
So our people, you know, the hair's on fire. They're out renting, mm-hmm, and they're staying in an Airbnb because they're,
yep,
out of their house if it's a residential type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they need to get back home and get back to a regular life. And they're,
sure,
probably, you know, breathing hard down your neck to try to get you to get it done.
Yeah, and that's why we talk about cycle times. That's why we're graded on how quickly we get people back in their into their house, because there's ALE, additional living expense. And if we give the insurance company a timeline, like, hey, we're going to get Mark Haney back in his building in 2 months, they hold us to that.
Mm.
And if we don't have a really good reason why not, they come back after us. And they state, like, hey, Lawton, you didn't get done in time. We're going after you for ALE. If we don't have a really good reason why, then that becomes an issue for us too.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of projects where we bid them off best case scenario. And as you know, in construction, you've had a lot of projects. Nothing ever goes on time, as I'm sure you can attest to.
Yeah.
So,
right now in the construction industry, I think the people that know me know I'm building a family compound. I just wrapped up my house, so built a couple other things out there because I got my kids living out there. Now we're working on a clubhouse. We've had trouble with permitting issues, but,
mm-hmm,
there's also challenges around the labor side. So you touched on, you've downscaled your, I guess, internal staff,
mm-hmm,
and using more outsources. What's the status of the labor market in construction right now? Is it better than it was a year or two ago? Is it worse?
No, for the employers, it's worse because labor rates are really, really high. You're competing with commercial contractors that are giving way higher rates. Everybody wants to get paid more. Like, the going rate has changed. Like, even to work at McDonald's now, look at the price.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, everything goes up, and insurance is very slow to catch on to that. So it's behind.
Oh,
so it's
interesting.
Like, so it's like you're paying a high labor rate, and your Xactimate code, and Xactimate's the program that most insurance companies use. You punch in that code, you're hoping it's going to populate the right rate. If it doesn't, you got to go and fight for it. And a lot of our projects, our average size job, we actually ran the numbers, our average size job is about $36,000, and we're doing thousands of them. But at that size job, my estimate is I don't have time to sit there and fight over every penny. If it's a big multi-million-dollar project, we can sit there and have our consultants come in and run all the numbers. On a small job, you're just kind of guessing at it. And that's where we kind of lost our ways, because we have all these projects going, and a lot of them were losing money. And, like, you can't chase them all. I mean, all of our guys are burnt out. There's just too many jobs. They're juggling too much. So
interesting. So I own a concrete company too, that small time concrete company. And I think we've got 10, 15 employees, something like that. Yeah. And it's, you know, we're doing 1 to 2 projects at a time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're kind of bouncing back and forth. And it's a challenge. And it's a challenge getting the right people that are qualified to do the job at a price that, you know, we can afford to pay. But just getting good people that know how to do skilled work. How is that right now in comparison to where it was 2 or 3 years ago? Are there less people that want to do this kind of work than,
yes,
than there used to be?
Yes, it's really difficult right now because you have all the new generation coming in. Well, I see a new shift now. There's a lot more push now for trades again. It's kind of become the new hip thing to do, is actually have a trade skill because you make great money at it, because there's a whole generation that don't really have any trade skills.
Yeah,
like everybody became.
Yeah, what's an electrician make these days? They make 100 bucks an hour
at least,
yeah. Yeah, is it over 100 bucks an hour? Which of the trades, because you're dealing with every single one of them.
I mean, our lowest trade through Xactimate is like $58 an hour. I mean, our technicians are all in the 30 to 40 range. I mean, within reason.
But when you go out and hire a sub, they're, you know, they're,
yeah,
you know, the, or if you hire like a union electrician.
Yeah, well, I mean, the unions and so we do prevailing wage, and those, okay, those rates are all controlled by, you know, the GC contractors.
Those
so
are pretty high.
We punch
rates
in those numbers.
Too.
They are very high rates, but like those projects are actually more lucrative for us because it also adds in our profit as well. On the other side of it, when you're doing it non-union, non-prevailing wage, you're taking all the risk. You know, we have all the overhead, the liability, the work comp, all the insurances. So
all your stuff's prevailing wage, huh?
Not all of it, no. So we're just now dabbling in that. That's a new sector for us. That's new for us.
We do probably half our stuff's prevailing wage at our concrete company.
You know, we like it.
The employees love it because they're getting paid a lot more money. So
until you go back.
Then you go back, they work on my house and they're pissed.
100%.
That's funny. Yep. Okay, so what's the biggest, besides the employees and all that, you've got the insurance people not handling well. So is there a pivot happening in the business now?
There is a pivot happening. In the entire industry, there's a pivot happening. So to kind of get back to like different kind of trades, all the trades that are highly lucrative, Sacramento's saturated. So everybody wants to be a restoration contractor and do water mitigation where you show up, you drop off the big blue machines, they keep making reoccurring revenue. Mm. I mean, that's very lucrative. There's thousands of restoration contractors that only do mitigation and water cleanup that used to be janitorial companies or only do that one trade. Well, the TPA companies come in, they go, if you want the water mitigation, you have to also take the build back. They got smart. They realized if you can't have just the highly lucrative part, you have to do both.
And that's interesting.
So like we're a full service contractor on these programs, and in order to get the water mitigation, we have to also agree to do the build back portion for them. So and that was hard for us because doing all the build back jobs, and also we'd be doing build back jobs for other mitigation companies that couldn't do the build back. And so we're doing all that. We're probably doing 70% of our work is still GC reconstruction just through restoration, and the rest of it is all mitigation, abatement, contents, you know, hazmat, and those are all highly lucrative. It's just there's less of that volume. There's a lot more GC work.
Okay.
So we're trying to find a way to make that still work and profitable. And we've been going to a lot more analytical side of it, getting more programs involved, trying to find out how we can beat the system because there's tons of work out there. It's just not lucrative. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to figure out, instead of saying no to it, we're going to say we're going to do less of it until we figure out how to scale it in a way that we can actually make money versus paying our guys to work.
Yeah, exactly. So, you don't want to, you don't want to lose market share, lose employees and all that. So you've got to take some business that's a little less profitable.
Yep.
But I like the idea of figuring that out. It's interesting because one of the things we talk about are the backyard advantage and creating an advantage in your business. Backyard advantage is an advantage for entrepreneurs because we get them connected up, whoever you want to know in Sacramento. It's like, if you're an entrepreneur and you're part of our club, if you will, you can get connected and that can help your business. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more to it than that. But also in business, we're looking for, I guess, that making those decisions where you're like, how do I angle it where I create myself an advantage? And maybe it's a high margin advantage. So because we do this and this, or we specialize in just this, you can get a better margin and make a little bit more, make a lot more money.
Correct. Yeah. Adding services on has always been like what most companies want to do. When you scale, is find another symbiotic thing you can do to add on to your already existing business. So it sounds good in theory, just finding a way to make sure you're not losing money as you do that.
Yeah.
Because so.
Well, thinking about what the most profitable, like I had a security company, I still do have one, but I had a group of security companies. And one of the things that we discovered was that we needed our own brand of product. And so, and it ended up being a high margin product, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the house brand, if you will. It was all, it was a separate entity, but that was, when we started selling some of that stuff, we realized, we're making quite a bit more money on our product.
Yeah.
And so it was almost like a little bit of a secret sauce, if you will. It's a simple little thing, but it was an advantage where we had more margin. Mm-hmm. Is there a piece of your business that's kind of like that for you?
Yeah, that's the water mitigation, the asbestos abatement, and all those other trades that are very, very difficult to do. A lot of licensing needed, a lot of insurance needed for that, but they're very, very lucrative.
Okay.
The problem is the amount of volume you get on that versus the other side. It's a volume issue.
Okay.
So
is kind of the idea how to grow that?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that leads to the other business.
Exactly. Yeah. Correct.
Yep. Okay. Makes sense.
And
okay,
then teaching our managers too, when they go out there, not to just be a one-trick pony. When you go out there, look for add-ons while you're already there, trying to make less trips. We've had big issues scaling up where a water mitigation manager goes out, sells the mitigation, then hands it off to a recon manager. Trucks are passing on the freeway, hands it out. We got to find a better way. Like, my truck was just there with a 3D camera. Why do I need three different managers to drive back out to the same job site? That's not efficient. How can we find a better way to do that where it's one drive and we save all that overhead?
Yeah.
But when you're scaling and you're growing, that somehow gets lost sometimes. Yeah. So.
Well, I think that's a lesson for any business too. So we sold a variety of products in my old company. I have one security company now that does casino work all over the country. Mm-hmm. If somebody just calls up and says, I need a couple of cameras, well, then aren't you going to ask the other questions? What's going on with the project? Oh, mm-hmm. Well, I also need some recording devices and some other stuff too. There's always add-on stuff. And you know, they might be buying it from someplace else, and it's time to kind of lock it in. So, some of that stuff's basic training that you would do as the owner, or maybe people who are seasoned would do automatically. But we become order takers as salespeople at the time.
Yep. And that becomes that scalability issue where you can do it, but is it scalable where the other manager could have the same mindset that you have? So you go from a single proprietor, a owner builder, you have that, you look around, you see all the different pieces. Well, the next manager might not if he's not trained properly. Mm-hmm. And when at scale, when you're hiring a bunch of new estimators, when you need a bunch of bodies, that gets lost. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. We scaled up a bunch and they are estimated. They show up there, they're writing a scope to get it approved. Because they're getting graded on that timeline. They have 5 days from the day my truck shows up. They have 5 days to get that estimate uploaded to get their score. So the adjuster and the insurance company gives them the thumbs up.
Yeah.
So they're not thinking about other sales. They're thinking about keeping their score right. So I always say insurance companies control us by volume. So,
one of the things we did, and you see this in Salesforce is all over, estimator is basically a salesperson.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, so, 100%.
Is we ended up giving them spiffs on certain high margin items or items that we wanted to get infused into the market, mm-hmm. and incentivize them to make sure that those.
We
are
did the same thing, and that was very successful. Is giving them a spiff off each other trade that they sold that they wouldn't be managing directly, but the indirectly they get a spiff on it, and it changes their whole mindset. Gives mm-hmm. them that owner mentality,
right?
Kind
right.
of eat what you kill type.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about anything else on your business, because I want to go into, like, being an entrepreneur is different. We're talking about the nuts and bolts of a construction company, which is interesting to me, but also what makes a great entrepreneur. I mean, you've become, a well-respected entrepreneur in Sacramento and in the region.
Oh, thank you.
We have a lot of mutual friends that Absolutely. Have high respect for you as a person and as an entrepreneur. Maybe talk to us about some of those, I guess, secrets to becoming successful. What made you a successful individual? Where does that come from?
Sure, I'll try my best. I mean, growing up very blue collar and very much worker oriented, it took me a long time to get to where I'm at now. And I mean, big shout out to EO in general for getting me outside my comfort zone. I've been an EO for 7 years and it changed my life with regards to looking outside the box. You grow up very worker mentality oriented where you just do your one trick pony. Like you grind, you work. I mean, I grew up working. I'd work for my dad 5 days a week and then I'd work the weekends on my own. That's I bought my first house. I'd work 7 days a week.
Yeah.
It just, no balance whatsoever.
How old were you when you bought your first house?
20.
20 years old?
Yeah, 20 years old.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're working for your dad at 16 in construction. And then that's the type of thing that can happen out there, listeners or watchers of this. If you start early, mm-hmm. the compounding effect adds up. You got your down payment on the house. Next thing you know, you're buying a house at 20 years old.
That's what I was going to say. I got a 10-year jump on most people because I started working full-time at 16. So mm-hmm. I have an unfair advantage because I was grinding at 16. I wasn't out partying. I didn't go to college. I thought about it, but I was making good money for my dad, and I was good at it. I was doing production drywall. I was fast. He taught me how to be fast, and you can make a lot of money with one crew.
My best friend, on June 8th, I'm going to date myself, 1981, June 8th, 1981, I graduated from high school, and my best friend turned 18 on that day as well, and he bought his first house on that day as an 18-year-old.
How awesome.
And because he'd worked for his dad, worked for, he saved money, and he ended up coming to work for me eventually, and he did really well, but, it's making those decisions early, in my opinion, the compounding effect of good decision making at age 16 when you're
Absolutely.
An able-bodied individual and you can work
Absolutely.
When there's a shortage of people that want to work.
Yep.
If you're one of those 16-year-olds, 18-year-olds, get a job. I mean, it's a great way to learn. Mm-hmm. Start setting aside some money instead of going blowing it on stuff.
Yep.
You can buy your first house. You can
yep.
have real wealth as a 41-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, instead of sitting around going, oh man, I'm 35 and I really don't got nothing to show for myself.
It's a cautionary tale. So then, yeah, so getting back on that, went from working 7 days a week doing that to getting a little bit of money. And then from there, started like getting more into business. I started reading some business books. Rich Dad, Poor Dad was one book that I read that really changed my life, that got me into real estate.
How old were you at that
age? I was like 2008. Right during the first crash, and like the company was doing well. Restoration was an industry that's not influenced by the market so whatsoever. It's a necessity. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where our company is doing really well during that first recession. I read that book. We're taking a family trip to Hawaii. I read that book and it changed my life. I came back, and during that time, Sacramento and North Highlands houses were selling for like $50,000.
That's a good time to read that book.
Yeah, I know. It just happened to happen. And like, you know, for the couple hundred thousand dollars, you could do damage in real estate. And I thought, like, what else can I do? I'm not a business guy per se. I'm a contractor. I know how to do construction. Well, real estate's very symbiotic. Buying distressed homes that scare most people is right up my alley. All I do is work on distressed homes. Every mitigation project. Most houses aren't brand new that have water issues or plumbing issues or mold issues. They're normally 20, 30 year old houses. So working on distressed properties is what I grew up doing. So I started buying houses back during that time, buying them and flipping them, buying them and holding them. And it's kind of compounding from 2008 all the way to now.
Wow.
And now we have about 30 doors we kept.
Wow.
So,
Wow. That's good timing, but also good on you that you've got the capabilities to do it in house. Sure. Do a lot of it yourself.
Yep.
So it just makes it, you know, you buy low and stuff's more than doubled.
Exactly.
If you bought it in, you know, 2010.
It's 10x, man.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the biggest hurdle. I mean, the biggest thing for me outside of doing the construction, the restoration, the family business was doing real estate. And then from there, that generated wealth. And then I got introduced to EO and guys like you. And you guys took me again out of my comfort zone into, you know, investing in companies and VC stuff. And I started doing that, started dabbling in that. And then from there, went to, you know, into hard money. And like, it's just kind of the natural progression. But it took like that first leap to get into real estate, have that win. And like, real estate has never done me wrong. It's the one thing. I've had so many losses in stock markets, other things. I love real estate because even when the property goes down, I still have something tangible. I can still leverage it. I can still rent. I can still cash flow it. Like, I just love real estate for that reason. With stocks, it's all out there in la-la land, right?
Yeah,
so I can't control anything. So a guy like me, I like having, even the property's down, I know if I can hold it long enough. Like every property I've sold, I checked before I came in here, we sold like 15 properties. Every property I've sold, I would have just kept it. It would have 5X. So it's like, it's
just, I flipped houses in around 2010. And
did you?
You kind of kick yourself in the butt a little bit. You're like, if I would just kept them all, that would have been in good shape. So that's funny. Yeah. But having the regrets is, you know, not the way to look at things, in my opinion, even though I sometimes do that a little bit, second guess my past decisions. But you said you read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Now, how important is reading in terms of your success? You mentioned EO, reading, the kinds of things that have kind of come into your life. Is it mainly that book, or do you?
Yeah,
is
that book? I'm a reader too. I do a lot of. I mean, I went through a phase where I was just doing a book a day or a book a week, and it gets overwhelming. There's like a general 5 or 6 principles that all these books teach us. Right after a while, it's a different author, but like they're all preaching the same basic thing. So like I did that one. I did E-Myth. Did the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. You know, the Patrick Lencioni books, the 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. As I started going through my business, building a company, more business books. But E-Myth was also a huge one for me too, because I was that guy. I was the owner-operator. I was the guy that could do it all and then wanted to build a company and then go, holy crap, but what are all these pieces? What's HR? What's this? What's that? Like, you do, it takes time, and that takes you away from what you're good at. When you're good at one thing, you might be great at framing a house. You might not be very good at running a company. It's completely different.
It is. So many of us, we're working in our business, not taking the time to work on the business.
Yep.
And again, it takes – you got to build it to a certain size, and it makes it easier to step away. So you're not the guy swinging the hammer in as much anymore. Probably when was the last time you got in and worked on a project?
So I haven't been in the field in probably about 5 years. When I was in the field, I was very hands-on, but all inspections, like just like going out there, meeting the teams, crawling in crawl spaces, going in attics, but I haven't probably been in the field in, I don't know, 15 years actually framing, working on my own stuff, just to sake, I still
dabbling.
Do it.
Yeah, I'm good at it. And that, you kind of like it because you're good at stuff.
Well, I mean, that's what I grew up doing. If it breaks, you got to fix it yourself. I never grew up hiring someone to do it. So that was also a big learning curve for me too, is learning to let go of those things because you can't scale a company and go around fixing stuff. And that was hard for me growing up a certain way. I'm not saying nothing wrong with that blue collar mindset, but you can't scale at that. Like even if stuff breaks in my house, I'm always telling my wife, I'm like, oh, I'm going to fix it. She's like, you're never going to fix that garage door. I'm like, but I could. She's like, I know you can, but you're not going to. You're never going to do it.
I'm the opposite. My wife says I'm the laziest man in America because I'm like, call the repair guy. You know, I'm trying to get myself so I do nothing. I'm like the so I was born that way.
Gotcha, that's funny.
To try to get out of work. You know, I'm the guy that's trying to get somebody else to paint the fence like Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer.
Oh,
I'm that guy.
That's funny.
It takes all kinds.
That's for sure.
Thinking about, but when I look at your family, beautiful wife, you've got the stud little boy.
Yeah,
I see stuff on Instagram. I think I follow Fallon on Instagram.
Yeah.
And, you know, you guys look like the perfect family.
Oh,
tell me what
Thank
happiness
you.
Is overall for Brett Lawton. What does that look like when you step back and I don't know what you do. Maybe you have your downtime where you're just thinking about, you know, what am I going to do with what I got?
Sure.
What makes you happy?
I mean, I just had EO yesterday. I was just telling all the guys in there. I'm like, I struggle with that balance of wanting to keep crushing it in business and also how much I love being around my family and like being around Parker. And he's such a sweetheart. He's 7 right now. And I was looking at old videos of him when he was little and like his sweet little voice. And you go, how much time, like what is the balance where it's like that struggle between you want to keep crushing and you hear about someone else is doing better than you and then you're on your phone with your kids and you go, where is that balance? I feel like no matter what, I'm at work, I want to be home with my family. When I'm with my family at home, I'm on my phone working. It just feels like that balance isn't there and I feel like all of us struggle with that. But to me, I mean, whenever I think of happiness, I think of my family. It's not fame, it's not notoriety, it's having your family safe. Mm-hmm. And being able to have the luxury of going, I just got back from Maui. It's not about money. It's about having the time to go and take him surfing for 7 days. Mm-hmm. And that experience and like how much fun that was for me as a dad. I love to surf and took him out there. He went and caught his first wave by himself. I mean, that there's no better joy I could think of like those moments where I'll remember that for the rest of my life. So
interesting. You talked about life balance, or you mentioned that it's hard for any of us maybe to obtain that if you own your own business. You choose one of those, you know, one of those decisions to like, I'm going to own my own business. It's a lot. It's a, you know, it can be a lot of work. And there's times when entrepreneurs are seeking life balance, yet they're in the middle of the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when it's your business, it's life balance is hard to find when you're in the middle of a crisis.
Oh,
now
yeah.
It's hard to find when you're crushing it as well.
Sure.
But let's talk about life balance. And like, would you allow yourself or did you allow yourself? And what would you say to other people in terms of, you know, people quit a job and start something. Should they expect life balance or should they expect to maybe have to build that life balance?
It's
and it might take
question.
A few years.
You got to build that life balance. That's to talk about the unfair advantage. Like when you're young and you have the energy, you touched on it earlier, you nailed it. When you're young and have all the energy, don't squander that. Like work your butt off, like work those seven days a week, because as you get older, you get more tired. You become smarter and more aware of wanting to be around your family. When you're in your 20s and even your 30s, you have more energy. Don't do it backwards. Don't spend all your time partying and goofing off. That way you have to work in your 40s and 50s and 60s. Do it the other way around. That way you have time to look back and you still have the energy to be with your kids. Like all these different things all matter to have a great life. Like you want to have energy. You want to be in good shape. You want to, like, these things don't just happen by chance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So like whatever, I mean, you can't always fix health issues. Like we're born with whatever we're born with. Like, but what you can avoid, things that are avoidable by just making basic decisions, I say make the right decision now. You know, don't be selfish because you're going to regret it later.
Yeah.
So
one of the things that comes up with this kind of topic is, you know, you hear people say it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? In business. I hear that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And I always think to myself, there are times when you need to be sprinting, right? There are times when you
both, for
can't
sure.
take the pedal off. You know, you got to be going for it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's at the beginning. It's always at the beginning, I suppose. But also, if there's an opportunity that opens up that, like, I have to seize this.
Sure.
And I'm going to intentionally take my life out of balance for 6 months, 12 months, some mm-hmm. undefined period of time. And, you know, getting your family to agree that this is like, look, I just bought this new company, or we're starting this new division, or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. I'm going to be a little out of balance for a while. Mm-hmm. Have you had to deal with that at all?
Yeah, okay. For sure. Many times. And I'm still way out of balance. I mean, I'm preaching what I can't practice right now.
So self-talk.
I'm trying to walk myself through it too. I'm doing a better job, but like none of us is entrepreneurs. Like you can't be balanced and be an entrepreneur. Like I think it's a cliche thing to say. All we're trying to do is as we get more successful, at some point, when's enough and when does that balance come back in? And for everybody, it's a sliding scale, right? Everybody's level of success is different. Everybody's level of family engagement is different. You got to find that happy medium for you. I just say when you're young, you know, a family, no kids, like that's the time to freaking grind.
Yeah.
Because what else do you have to do?
Yeah. It's interesting to see people settle too. I don't know if it's, you know, I'm the old man talking here. It seems like more people, and it might not be generational thing, but people end up wanting to settle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always surprising to me that people settle for such a low bar when they don't dream big. So you've already had tremendous success, yet you're not settling. What?
Sure.
Why? Is that something that, you know, where does that come from?
I still struggle with that. I mean, I'm trying to settle. It's just like, it's contagious. Like you get good at something, and it's also part of what makes you you. Oh. Like I wouldn't be me. I wouldn't be the same dad to Parker if I wasn't out there still doing the other part of it. Just like working out or having a sport you love to do, that makes you a better dad. Like you go have a great workout, you come home, you're more energetic for your kids. Sitting around all day, you're more. Like, it's all cause and effect. Same with a great business deal. Like all of us feed off that dopamine.
Yeah,
whatever it might
be. The taste of winning is so damn good.
Exactly. So
it only lasts for a second, but then
I mean, I'm not gonna say sorry for that, but I come on, that guy. If as long as it leads me down a path to not being away from my family for long periods of time, then I'll keep going after it.
Yeah.
So
interesting. Any thoughts in terms of leadership? Obviously, you've built a company with a lot of employees, and you know, mm-hmm. you've done a great job.
Any tips
for people out there that are getting, you know, trying to scale the business and get up to, you know, 70 mm-hmm. or 100 employees? And
sure.
You know,
I mean, as you're scaling up and finding the right managers, the biggest thing is like not thinking that you know it all and being okay with being the dumbest person in the room. I pride myself in being the dumbest person in the room. I love it. And like I just sit there and listen to my ops manager, my CFO, and all the different people talking because they're all way more brilliant than I am at their specific trade. I'm just the crazy CEO that has all the different ideas, and that's what makes it work. Is hiring brilliant people and finding those diamonds in the rough that are going to stay with you. It took me a long time. A lot of those came from even people I work with that I promoted, and other ones I found, and I went through a lot of turnover. But like that to me was a huge part of trusting people and then going that route, and also not being a tyrant and not thinking that, you know, a lot of business owners, they want to be the know-it-all. They like being the person, the Mr. Fix-It. And I went from that to like, I don't want that. That's not fun anymore. That's not bragging rights. I'm like, you walk in there, oh, thank God Lawton's here, you can fix it. Like, no one wants to hear that. I don't want to hear that. I want them to be able to fix it themselves. I think most young entrepreneurs, they go through that, like they like being that person. And I think it's also a detriment to building a company. Because employees get more accustomed to that, it's like your kids asking what's in the fridge versus opening the door, right?
Right.
They start asking for crazy stuff they know the answers to. Just because it's muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And I struggled with that for a while too.
So, yeah. Well, you're still a young guy and you've already overcome that, which is, I think a lot of people are, you know, saddled with that, way of thinking, and it's hard to break. So good on you that you have. So thinking about happiness, one of the things that I was thinking about what makes me happy the mm-hmm. other day. And I love the feeling of the people that I care about most having respect for me and appreciate me. And I feel like I'm making an impact on things that I'm working on. And so what kinds of things make you happy specifically? Is it going out and having fun? Like you mentioned, surfing with your son, or what kind of, like, deep down inside, what makes you like happy with you?
I mean, I just had a milestone. We had my dad's 80th birthday at my house. I had all the family over and had all the grandkids over. Everybody came up to the house. Everybody hosted my place. And, like, it was an amazing Sunday. My aunt came from the Bay Area. My dad's brother came from South Lake Tahoe. We went golfed in the morning and just built a little family back together. My family hasn't been really close like that in a long time. I've been pushing for it. And that, to me, was also, like, pure happiness, seeing different generations of my family all together in the same house that haven't been together in a long time, all together swimming with the kids, like four generations. And I just looked back, I sat there, I was like, this is so awesome to see. So that might be an example of
what makes you happy with you.
Okay. With me.
Right. Are you happy with yourself?
I don't think I'll ever be happy with myself. Sorry, Mark. I'm my biggest critic, but I mean, but it makes me happy for me. I mean, I've always been an athletic guy. I always like doing sports, snowboarding, surfing, wakeboarding, working out. It's always been a big part of like who I am. I couldn't do the other entrepreneurial side if I didn't do that. It's my release.
Interesting. So, you think you're unique in that? I mean, you're unique in your physicality. You know, you're ripped. You're in good shape. I know that's a focus. I like to work out too, right?
You look great, man.
A lot, but like I like CrossFit. I like doing yoga. I like doing hard things. It makes me feel better about me if I get off my butt and do something.
Sure.
Work up a good sweat. But I feel like it makes me a better person, makes me more sane, it makes me better at other things. So I feel like it affects family and business and social life and all that to go work out.
Yep, same. I go in the morning early. I never regret working out. Whenever I don't, I come home more cranky. I'm like, if I don't get my workout in and do my certain things, there's certain things in the day, I have to check off certain boxes. Otherwise, I don't feel accomplished. Mm. So like, I got to get my workout in, got to do my certain things every day. Otherwise, I'm just all over myself. And I come home and I have that written on my face. So it's like,
Up early and work out, or when do you find a way to work out?
I get up
out?
Around 4:30 or 5. I'm at the gym by 6:30.
Okay. Yeah. So early workout, and then from there you go to the office.
To the office, go to corporate, check in. I mean, half the time I'm just parking out front and working on my own. Like, I have a lot of real estate stuff I do from the same office, just like you. You have multiple hats you wear here, so I use that as my station. Yeah. And I go in there, do my thing for about, you know, half the day, 3/4 of the day, and then I've been doing a lot more marketing now, trying to grow the company. I've been getting outside of my comfort zone. Case in point, here I am doing this.
So, hey, that's right. If you need restoration, Brent Lawton is the man.
We got you. Thanks, Mark.
I love it. Okay, what did I not ask you that I need to ask you?
Oh, I don't know.
One thing I was thinking about is like EO, though you touched on it. You brought, or I guess we both brought it up, but like, what if someone's listening that is, you know, got a company that's doing a couple million bucks a year and they're thinking about, man, I want to grow. I've got a lot of desire to, you know, build a company with 100 employees, but I'm kind of small time. Mm-hmm. Any advice or thoughts about why they might want to join EO?
Sure, I'm a huge advocate of EO. Everybody I know that's not in EO, all I do is talk to them about how they need to join, because I was so against it in the beginning. Even the first 2 years I joined, I was trying to find a way to get out.
Because it's a waste of time. It takes a lot of time.
I mean, when you're a new business owner, you're like, I've been here for 4 or 5 hours, and like, dude, like, what? I don't have time for this. I'm like, what's the value? What clients do I get out of this?
Exactly.
You know, it's all the wrong mindset. So I went through all those struggles, and I realized it's the exact opposite of that. It's about a peer-to-peer base that if you're sitting in a room with, you know, 10 dudes, your worst day is someone else's Monday morning coffee. Mm-hmm. And that to me was huge. It's like my biggest stress. Someone else looks over like, I can help you with that like this. And it also makes you realize like how minuscule everything is. Like when you look, you know, you see those charts and like, you're like, they show the speck of the earth down here, how big the universe is, and they show your problem. Like that's kind of like how EO is in business. Yeah. Like everybody, different levels of business guys. You got guys that are, you know, $100 million businesses or had huge exits, and then you're worried about payroll. Like it's cool to be in the room because these guys can offer assistance and also show you it's not so bad.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of value from that. And also seeing other people's struggles and guys coming in and struggling and like almost in tears, and then a couple months later, a year later, selling for a massive exit. I go, we all go through it. It's not like these guys have this awesome, this trajectories like this. These guys all go through ebbs and flows. It's about how you overcome those. And I've seen guys that have been stressed out about payroll to go and sell their company. I go, that's inspiring. Because to me, I'm like, I feel like everybody's always just constantly winning. Yeah. All you hear about, all you see on Instagram, it's always just the good stuff. You never hear about the bad. EO, when you do your 5%, you get to hear about bad stuff.
Yeah. When you start to 5%, one of the things that happens in the entrepreneurs organization is we get in these small groups, there are about 8 to 10 of us on average. In Sacramento, there's about 100 people total, and we're in these small groups called forums. And we get together and we share about our lives and business, family, and all that kind of stuff. And to get to, you know, so that it's just not small talk, oh, yeah, sales and this and that. You try to get something that is like 5%. good, great, and 5% that may be really negative. So if you just get in there and share, you know, all the day to day, that's nobody gets anything out of that. But when you start talking about the things that really get you emotional and maybe vulnerable, that's when we all learn.
Yep, 100%. Yeah. So I learned a lot from that. And also, even outside of forum, as you grow in EO, you start to realize you can, I mean, I can call on you. I have a whole handful, whole roster of top tier business guys in Sacramento that I can just text. And like that gives you so much value because all of us go out alone for so long. Yeah. You make so many mistakes going alone. Yeah. It's like a pride thing. And also, you're scared to reach out to people and you don't know who to ask. And you make so many bad decisions. Like if I could go back in time and join EO sooner and start asking the right questions, I would have avoided so many mistakes. Because it's just
well, I love the idea. So you, me, and Scott went over to Bennett's one day and had lunch, and we talked about Airbnb strategies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Right? Yeah. So that's the type of thing that you, if you're on the construction project, I mean, you care a lot about real estate, but who are you going to talk to about it, right? It's like, how do I get involved in a network that might not be, there's no conflicts. You're not with a bunch of other construction guys where you're, hoarding your secret sauce
exactly,
and stuff.
Exactly,
okay, so words of wisdom, last question. Words of wisdom for aspiring entrepreneurs.
Oh, man. I thought I did that.
You're spent.
I'm spent. I mean, I'll go back. I guess I'll go back and talk again about grinding when you're young. I mean, from my journey, from my space where I came from, not having a background in college education, not being business oriented, mine was just a grind. So if the kids like that are growing up like me, that are in the construction industry or that have that work ethic, don't shy away from that. That's your superpower. And like even right now, it's transitioning again. As we just talked about, skilled tradesmen make more money now than ever.
Yeah.
If you can do something, you're able-bodied now, you're an asset. Like you are not the norm. So I would just say grind out right now, work hard, try to stockpile as much money as possible, and buy a home.
Yeah. Stockpile the money, kids or young people. Yeah, exactly. Everybody's kind of a kid to me these days. Stockpile the money.
Don't buy a fancy car, buy a house.
Exactly. Don't go spend the money. Don't go out to dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Cut down on your Netflix accounts and Prime accounts and all that. And
don't be Instagram rich.
I mentioned my buddy bought his house on his 18th birthday, the day we graduated from high school. I was, that's when I woke up and I bought my first house when I was 20 as well. And
awesome.
It was, but I didn't really think about it until he bought his house. It was like, click. Hey, dummy.
Yeah.
You know, and I had already been saving money, but save a heck of a lot more so you can go buy a house.
Exactly, yep. I never thought about it either. And I look back now, people are always like very impressed by it. When I was in the middle of doing it, I just never even thought it was anything other than what I was supposed to be doing. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Wow. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks,
appreciate
Mark.
Your friendship.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise.
I think some great nuggets today. So
Thank you.
I appreciate you, buddy.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.